From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the paycheck of a small business owner. What is this owner making? How much can she keep? The myth of business ownership is that one size fits all. Some small business owners have big margins and are profitable. Others are making very little money after paying employees and handling expenses. And it's also not fair to say that all business owners want the same things from Albany or Washington. But generally speaking, there are organizations that lobby for them. Unshackle Upstate does that on the state level. The National Federation of Independent Businesses is involved on multiple levels. And then there is the interaction with local governments. One Finger Lakes business in particular has a long and difficult story in that regard. So this hour, a conversation about what businesses want from government, especially as we work through state affairs this hour. But we're going to talk about it from a lot of different levels. Welcome to Greg Gorilla, the executive director of Unshackle Upstate. Greg, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much, Evan.
And also here is Seth Olney. He is the owner of The Only Place down on Cuca Lake. That is a regional deli and market, and it's become kind of a Finger Lakes destination. He was on this program not too long ago talking about some of the struggles he's had, was back in court yesterday, so fresh off court appearance. Nice to see you back here. We got a lot to talk about.
Mr. Dawson, thank you.
Well, it's always good to have you. And I want to start by making sure our listeners know what Greg's organization, Unshackle Upstate, is. So, Greg, what's the short description there?
Sure. Unshackle Upstate was founded a little over 10 years ago. It's an upstate business, employer, taxpayer, and advocacy organization comprised of the large upstate New York chambers of commerce, trade associations, individual employers. We advocate in Albany to seek positive change for a growing economy and growing and strong communities across upstate New York.
There's a lot to talk about in terms of what is on your menu of need or desire for 2018, Greg, but I want to start with SALT, state and local taxes. That has come up. We had a whole discussion with CPAs, the driest hour ever of this radio program. But, you know, I mean, a lot of feedback because people were confused about what is going on with SALT in the federal bill, what the governor's work in Albany to sort of counter that's going on. What's your understanding of what's going on with state and local taxes?
Well, unfortunately, there's still a lot of confusion about it. And I think a lot of that's coming from actions since federal tax reform was passed coming out of Albany. A couple of weeks ago, the governor, through the Department of Tax and Finance, put out a series of proposals to respond to the loss of SALT deductibility in New York State. And he's been around the state. Every time he's had the chance to speak on the issue or any issue, this is largely what he focuses on. I think he's labeled the entire issue as a missile directly aimed at New York State. So the Department of Tax and Finance puts out a series of proposals that would shift New York State from a income tax structure to a payroll tax structure. It would add things called the unincorporated business tax, these sort of things that would still remain deductible. But it was a 37-page report with 13, 14, 15 options and multiple sub-options. It added to the confusion. And that's one of the things that we hear from employers all the time, and I'm sure Seth could speak to this, on any issue, not just taxes. It's that confusion and instability gives any business owner or employer pause to invest.
All right. So fair to say then that at this point, there's still a lot of confusion in the landscape about SALT.
A lot of confusion. The governor did come out this past week in part of his 30-day amendments to the state budget. And the latest proposal would be what's called an employer compensation expense tax. It's 5% on the wages paid by an employer. It would be optional, so certain employers could opt in if they saw fit, if it met their business model. Employees would get a tax credit, employers would get a tax credit, and employees would then receive a 5% pay cut because that would be necessary to make all the math balance. So it's a very still confusing process.
Is there anything that you want to see Albany or the governor do on this issue that they haven't done?
Absolutely. And look, at the end of the day, as I've described it before, we have a Chinese menu full of choose-your-own tax adventures to try to address the loss of deductibility on state and local taxes. Why is this such a big issue for New York State? Why? It's because we have the highest state and local taxes in the entire country. Federal tax reform occurred in December. 45, 46 states out of 50 aren't worried about this. We have such high and local taxes that now that there's been changes at the federal level, it's laid those even more bare than they were before. So what do we want to see? How is this not seen as an opportunity to finally address some of these issues? I mean, we have a state budget that came out a couple of weeks ago, a state budget proposal that increases spending by more than the 2% cap we stayed to in recent years. It adds $1 billion in new taxes. This is exactly the formula that got us into this problem. And I understand that reducing spending or going after some of those sacred cows in state governments is very difficult politically and otherwise. But at some point, we need to address the core problem, and that's that we tax too much in the state.
All right. So before we get into the impact, and you're right. I mean, Seth, as a small business owner, can talk about what the climate is like at that level. I know there are listeners saying, okay, you're saying you want to keep spending down, or you want to cut taxes, but where are you going to cut spending?
Okay.
Let's get specific. Where do you want to cut it?
So there's a couple of different ways to go about this. Obviously, I will tell you, and you'll hear a lot of feedback, that we spend too much on healthcare and education. That's by far and away the largest portion of the New York State budget. We spend twice as much on Medicaid than Texas and Florida combined. More on Medicaid than Texas and Florida combined. But I understand that those are very difficult things to address from a spending restraint standpoint in Albany.
Why do you think they're difficult?
Because they're protected by very powerful special interests.
I mean, certainly everyone from teachers' unions to, I think, a lot of people who want to see increases in education spending would say, you cut spending to schools and you cut spending to a very, very important aspect of quality of life in this state here.
So let's go about it from a different approach. Something that Unshackled Upstate's been very vocal on this year. We have in New York State core cost drivers, things that I've been on the show and talked about before, like prevailing wage, like scaffold law, our pension system. All of these things, workers' compensation insurance the state pays as an employer, all of these things cost more in New York State than they do everywhere else. You could fundamentally and structurally reform these built-in state cost drivers and produce billions in savings. We didn't cut a single Medicaid program. We didn't cut a dollar to education. But again, it's proven very difficult.
Okay. And what do you think is the main reason, as I see the phone ringing already, you've already touched a few nerves, Greg.
Sure.
We haven't even gotten to Seth. What do you think, if we're paying more in those areas, workers' comp, pensions, et cetera, than just about anywhere in the country, what has driven that? Why?
I think when times were good in New York State, there was a lot of incentive, politically speaking, to just increase benefits to a degree that had become very hard to sustain in 2018.
Why do you look at Medicaid and education spending at the top of your menu when, as you say, there's so many different places you could cut?
They're simply the biggest pieces of any state budget. And let's take Medicaid, for example. Medicaid, I believe, there's 33 benefits associated with Medicaid, 33, 34. 13 or 14 are mandated by the federal government. The remainder, each state gets to pick and choose if those particular mandates or those particular services and the costs associated with them meet their populations. Every state's different after those 13 mandated benefits. In New York State, we're the only state in the country that offers every optional mandated benefit.
Some people think that's a badge of honor.
Some people do. Another way to go about it in terms of Medicaid reform is not cutting individual benefits, is look at local control. In New York State, we have counties that pick up 20, 22, 23% of a Medicaid bill. It's the single biggest driver of county property taxes. When you talk about mandate relief, you talk about the Medicaid mandate on local governments. I think anyone would agree that the health care needs of residents and communities in the Southern Tier are largely different than those in the South Bronx. If counties are picking up the tab on paying for Medicaid, shouldn't they have some sort of control on the optional benefits offered in their communities? And if the public demands that these benefits be added, that these benefits be included, they can do that through elections.
Okay. And so I think what I'm hearing from you, Greg, and Greg's executive director of Unshackle Upstate, is that some of these policies were formed when, as you say, times were better, and that it has become, in your view, an outdated model, an unsustainable model. Is that fair?
We're spending $168 billion. There can be no sacred cows. And take education again, and I'm not necessarily a proponent for cutting education spending, but we spend more per student than any state in the country. We do not have the best public education system in the country. So it's not always more money is the answer. And I'm not saying I have the answer, but we have middling results and we spend the most. So there can be no sacred cows when we are facing a $4.5 billion deficit. We're looking at raising taxes by $1 billion or more. We can get into how we're going to raise taxes and how those affect upstate. communities and the upstate economy, there needs to at some point be a holistic look at how we spend in state government.
All right. Seth Olney is the owner of a small business on Keuka Lake. You employ how many people when you're open?
When we're open at max between full and part-time, probably 14 in a good year.
And you've grown. I mean, you've grown significantly since opening when? When did you open?
We opened April 23rd, 2008. This is our 10-year anniversary we're going on. So at the time, it was maybe two other full-time and some part-time employees. But now, full-time by my standard, which is 35-plus hours for the 4 or 5 months we're open, I've got 8, 9 employees now, plus another 4 or 5 that are part-time. And it's been great, the revitalization of the Finger Lakes in the last even 10 years since I've been here, and 38 as a lifetime resident. It's been remarkable. So I'm pleased with the direction we're heading overall.
In 10 years, if you could go back to March 2018, 2008, you're a month from opening, and you could let yourself know what you didn't know at the time, what have you learned most about running a business in this state?
I think ultimately, in this state particularly, I talk to friends from Pennsylvania that are always kind of chastising me for why am I still here for love of place, if nothing else, is always my short answer. But just making myself aware in terms of the exorbitant regulations, I think, particularly with my recent issue with State Liquor Authority, kind of the expertise that you need to tackle each of these endeavors, whether it's DEC, SLA, Board of Health, each of them has their own kind of encumbrances and hurdles, which makes it very difficult to navigate. So many times I've kind of just ran by the seat of my pants. I wish, tell myself to step back and really look at the bigger picture and what is the proper path. Because if you start down the wrong trajectory, you often have to work twice as hard to get back to where you originally were. So,
have you had more challenge as a business owner from state government or local government?
Recently, clearly local has been an overzealous small government, even a zoning board of appeals, using too much of their own power and abuse of power.
And hold on, let me just jump in, Seth, only because when we start using terms like zoning board, I can hear people changing the channel. Don't. I want to explain something because this is a story that is weird and fascinating, and it's captured attention from media outlets all across this region because Seth's the owner of a small business in the Finger Lakes. He gets, and I'm going to try to simplify this as best I can, gets a license from, multiple levels. The town locally says, okay, you're going to expand your business. You're going to put in some beer taps. You're going to do what Seth called a beer garden. And then they came by and said, wait, what are you selling? You're selling beer?
3 years after getting the State Liquor Authority.
Well, yes, you gave us a permit to do beer taps, and we're actually just going to sell beer out of them. And then the town said you can't, which is a weird thing to do after giving you a permit to do that. And just recently, the State Liquor Authority said to the town, you're ridiculous. That of course he is selling beer and that he's got every right to, but you're still in court. You were in court in Rochester yesterday.
Why? Yesterday was the result of an Article 78 petition that I filed 2 years ago. Seen under Judge Dennis Bender from Seneca County, ruled in my favor. Of course, the town did not like that ruling, took it to the State Supreme Court Appellate Division, 4th Department, down on 50 East Main, which is where I was yesterday, sat in front of a panel of 5 judges, and my attorneys were, as well as the town's attorneys, kind of hammered with some various questions and kind of sent on our way. So we're awaiting that outcome. Anywhere from 15 to 60 days from now, we expect to hear what the outcome will be. We hope for a positive result and opening up our 10th season or our 10th year in business with flying colors. We'll see.
All right. So, and before I get to some of our phone calls and kind of continue to work through Unshackle Upstate's priorities, Seth, you happen to be in a place where, I won't name names because I don't know if I'm allowed to, but I know that there are a lot of significant political figures who come into your store. Some from Rochester, some from statewide office. Fair, yeah?
Very fair.
Okay. You've gotten to know a lot of them, and you know them from all across the political spectrum. So if there is some sort of stereotype that, Democrats want to tax you to death and Republicans want no regulations and anarchy, which is neither one is true, Seth has seen people from both major parties come in and try to get to know his problems and understand them. Have you found them to be receptive?
From both sides, whether it's former Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy, Tom O'Mara, Tom Richards, Phil Palmisano, people from both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats alike, that see an issue like mine and both kind of scratch their head saying, how did we get here? How have we let ourselves become so overregulated that a small business like mine struggles just to stay open the 6-8 months of the year that I am open. You find that they have a lot more in common than they would let you to believe when they're on the political stump.
Okay, and what do you think, Greg Barilla, is a lesson from that? For those of us who stereotype on this issue, you know, do you believe, in your organization's viewpoint, that you're getting reception from both major parties, that the desire is there, whether it's Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli or it's the Robux and Rich Funkies of the world, the desire is there to allow businesses to grow without being quote-unquote overregulated or overtaxed?
I do, especially in upstate New York. And you just mentioned a series of lawmakers locally, Joe Morelli, Senator Rich Funky, Senator Joe Robach, who have worked with us on a host of issues and continue to work with us, regardless of party labels. There's still a very rational middle, I think, in upstate New York. And most elected officials in this part of the world, I think, understand that a growing economy with businesses like Seth's solves a lot of our problems. It makes our communities more vibrant. It adds local dollars into the tax rolls. It allows for responsible spending on social programs and community programs. So I would absolutely agree.
All right, I want to get our first phone call because Keith in Farmington wants to weigh in on the subject of prevailing wages. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan,
off speakerphone. Get off speakerphone, Keith. Come on.
I'm not on speakerphone. I'm on my headset.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you sound like you're in a... Keep it brief. Go ahead, sir.
Hang on. Wait a second.
It is always something. It is always right, something
sorry.
With Keith.
All right. Sorry. I want to speak on the prevailing wage. The one thing about the prevailing wage, what it does, it prevents people from the stereotype driving through Home Depot's parking lot and picking up people to work on a state-funded job that's paid for with taxpayer dollars. Because with every prevailing wage job, you have to submit a certified payroll, which states, you know, the hours and how much you're paying. But on the downside or the upside, if I'm paying somebody, and I'll use my employees who are getting paid quite well to work on this one job, but I know she's taking all the money that she's making on this job and is just going to pour it back into the economy because she wants to redo her kitchen with it. Now, I could see if she took the money and just put it in the bank or bought stock with it and let it sit there for 30 years, she would take it out of the economy. But she doesn't. In fact, all my employees take what they make and they just shove it back into the economy by purchasing items or paying for services that they will buy with it. So it's like moving money around. Now, they're getting paid quite well, but they're also getting very high taxes taken out on their paychecks. And I really don't have a problem paying prevailing wage.
Well, stay there for a second, Keith. Let me ask our guest to weigh in.
Sure.
Greg Barilla, Executive Director of Unshackle Upstate. Go ahead, Greg.
Sure. When Unshackle Upstate talks about prevailing wage, we talk about reform, not repeal. And unfortunately, in New York State, prevailing wage isn't really an accurate snapshot of the prevailing wage in a given region for various reasons of the way it's calculated. And while that higher wage does allow Keith's employees to, you know, theoretically and hopefully spend more into the economy, it also raised the cost of prevailing wage projects, your typical public construction projects, by, depending on the region, anywhere between 15, 20, 25%. So now, again, when we talk about spending problems in New York State, for New York State to build a road, for New York State to build a bridge, for New York State to build a school, we're paying a premium. And again, I'm talking about reforming prevailing wage, not talking about getting rid of it.
Well, how would you reform it? What would you do to reform it?
I think you'd like to
lower
have
lower it.
What's that?
Would you lower it, the prevailing wage?
You'd have it be reflective of the actual entire construction market in a given region.
Well, it is because my prevailing wage schedule that I get with each job states as to what region I'm in, how much I pay. And there's certain parts of the state is higher only because of the cost of living is higher. Up here, it's a little bit less. And the prevailing wage takes up two parts. One is the wage weight, and then the other part is wage weights with benefits. And that's the other part that creates the total prevailing wage.
But when those wage determinations come down from Albany, what Albany is supposed to do is a survey of various employers and their employees and given trades and what they're making. Albany doesn't do that. And that's part of the, one of the reforms we've been talking about, is that Albany conduct, it's the Department of Labor, conduct a survey, an industry-by-industry survey of the actual wages paid in given regions. Unfortunately, they've been pretty much dictated through other means that haven't been statistically valid independent surveys.
Well, I can see where if they spent more time and money trying to get a more accurate, say, regional prevailing hourly wage rate, it may differ, but it's not going to differ by leaps and bounds. It may be different by $2 or $3 an hour, which isn't, when you look at the whole picture, isn't going to be a huge sum. I mean, you could eliminate the prevailing wage totally and just let, you know, buyer beware, and whoever you get the cheapest worker in there doing the job, and you just hope they know what they're doing. And this is what happens in other states. Like, you know, people always mention Texas, how the cost of doing business in Texas is way cheaper. But did you know in Texas, compensation is an option? It's not required. They don't have to require to have workers' comp on their employees.
All right, Keith, thanks.
Of course it's cheaper.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call, Keith. Greg, so if you can get there, would you eliminate prevailing wage entirely?
No, that's not what we're calling for. We're calling for reform prevailing wage. And what, like Keith just said, $2-3 and maybe $2-3 on the benefit side as well. Well, you know, all of a sudden it starts being real money, and we're spending billions in public construction in this state annually. I mean, think about the MTA and building a subway in New York City and what that costs. If you can save a couple of percent here, a couple of percent there, the Tappan Zee Bridge, $1 billion project, a couple of percent, it starts adding up to real money.
All right. And Seth, as a small business owner, I don't know the prevailing wage impacts you, but can I ask you just in 10 years, how you feel sort of state regulated? Obviously, you've had to deal with a lot with the local government.
I'm not going to say escape, but because of the seasonality of my business, yeah. I'm not quite as far held to a critical standard. Minimum wage for me has always been quite a bit above starting off. You know, 10 years ago, $10 was the starting rate. If you came to my store today, $12 would be the starting rate. That was just something that I wanted to invest in my employees and have quality people dealing with the clientele, as you said, mostly second homeowners. They deserve to have the best. And I work that in to my overall business model. As far as prevailing wage goes, I know somebody like my father, small business guy, works construction, maybe gets a bid to do some culvert replacement. Local construction guy might be $20-25 an hour. Prevailing wage might be $47. You know, so for him to bid a job, he can be nowhere near as efficient as he should be, which I think is always kind of the point of the private sector, which is to get the best job for the cheapest and the quickest, not in a buyer beware sense, but, you know, let's get it done.
All right. So listeners, if you want to weigh in on what you're hearing, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Here's from Sheila, and I'm going to direct this to Greg. She writes, your guest brings up 2 points about SALT, state and local taxes. First, corporations get the tax breaks, individuals do not. How many times have upstate New Yorkers been burned by this? Maybe our taxes are so high because corporations aren't paying their share. By his admittance, paychecks are smaller. That's her first point. You want to respond to that?
Yeah. excuse me, Evan. I don't think that was a complete understanding, and I may not have articulated it well. State and local tax issue and the way it's been addressed in Albany completely ignores that, yes, federal taxes were reduced for corporate taxpayers in New York State, from 35% to 21% as they were across the country, but personal income taxes at the federal level were also reduced. So many people, particularly if you are not in what would be considered the very, very high end wealth, segment of taxpayers in the state. You're talking about millionaires who own multiple homes, often downstate, pay property taxes through the roof in Long Island, Nassau, Westchester. If you remove those people who will be most affected by SALT deductibility because they were paying the highest state and local taxes, I think most independent examinations, regardless of their political affiliation or what they feel about federal tax reform, particularly for upstate, most people will likely see a tax reduction. And most people will not have to deal with all these problems with state and local tax deductibility because their state and local taxes don't reach the threshold necessary. It's when you get into the individuals who have hundreds of thousands of dollars in state and local tax liabilities. Now, another problem is in New York State, we rely very, very heavily on these individuals to fund all the operations in the state, which is sort of a little bit contradictory, because I think I've been on the show to talk about an extension of the millionaire's tax and why it's bad to keep relying upon the highest 1%, because eventually they will leave. And now that tax base is again going to be paying more taxes, and you're hearing from the other side that they're very worried they will leave and they will take that revenue that goes to the state coffers with them.
All right. Her second point on this is someone who works in an educational setting. She says, we do have an expensive educational system here. But your guest overgeneralizes when he says the system is not that good. Take the cities out and see what you have. Exemplary districts. The problem with the cities is poverty. Maybe they need those bigger paychecks to make ends meet.
Obviously, I was overgeneralizing. I mean, there's, I think, and don't quote me on this, 700-some school districts in New York State.
There are hundreds for sure, yeah.
Many of them do exceptional work. But across the board, we do not excel in terms of a top two or three states in performing for education. And we do spend the most. And again, I'm not necessarily advocating for education spending. The earlier question was more of a discussion of, okay, if you want to look at how to reduce a state budget, you do have to look at where we spend the most. I think I gave some alternatives. And on the issue when it comes to poverty, USA Today yesterday, New York Post yesterday, front page, New York State, 50th in taxes. 50th, last in the country. We often cite the Tax Foundation study every year, Business Tax Climate. It takes the taxes and relates them specifically to business growth and what the impact is on business development. New York State has 49th or 50th every year the last 7, 8, or 9 years. Maybe if we had an environment that was conducive to economic development, economic growth, hiring, wage escalation, we could solve some of these poverty issues without through private sector means.
On the subject of spending, Mike and Victor wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I think we the person there mentioned the education spending. I think we spend double what the national average is per student. It's ridiculous, and we're ranked 20th. On top of that, our public medical spending is almost double what it is for like California or Texas. Those are the two areas we absolutely need to cut. Those are hard choices, but they have to happen, because if not, guys like me, because the middle class is really getting it, I'm trying to be polite, but we get it stuck to badly and on taxes. And, you know, I don't want to spend $9,000 a year on property taxes. So when my kids grow up, I'm out. I don't see how, unless these things change, you know, and my kids, and it's sad because my kids will never want to stay here to live, because the economy is so lousy. And that's the sad part. So I'm going to follow my kids. I'm not going to stay here, because how can I? As much as I love the area, it's impossible. And it's very frustrating. And no one seems to understand that in Albany. Thank you.
Mike, thank you for the phone call. I want to return to a point that Greg made earlier that we hear often. When you look at SALT, when you look at the debate about tax burdens, we do have what some describe as generous or a high level of Medicaid allocation in this state. And again, as I said earlier, I'm not taking a values judgment on that one way or another. I'm not saying that is evidence of something negative or positive. I'm just observing that that is true. And Greg points out that that burden then partially goes to county governments, and that that's partially why you think property taxes are as high as they are.
At the county level.
Okay. So if we were to cut Medicaid spending, as you prescribe, and give county government some relief, do you expect then that we would see a direct line of property taxes?
I do. And I think if you brought in Cheryl Donolfo or a member of the county legislature from this county, any of the surrounding counties, I spoke with the county governments of 14 Western New York counties last week. Their number one concern was the fact that their budgets, depending on the county, are anywhere between 85% to 95% mandated. The costs are mandated from Albany. The vast majority of that is coming from Medicaid. So I think you bring a county government leader in, you have to hear it from me. They'll tell you that if mandated Medicaid costs were reduced, they would be able to lower property taxes.
You hear Mike talking about following his kids out of the state, that he's got kids who don't think they can stay here. You want to respond to some of that, Greg?
Absolutely. I'll lead with the fact I'm 34 years old. So a couple of years ago, I went on a tour of the country that I think a lot of people my age then did. It's when all your college friends get married. And I went to school in the Southern Tier. I grew up in Western New York. I live in Rochester. It's where the vast majority of my friends are from as well. These weddings I went to were in Charlotte, North Carolina. They were in Jacksonville, Florida. They were in Austin, Texas. They were in Charleston, South Carolina. And these were people who now live there who would do anything to move back to Buffalo, to Rochester, Syracuse, if they thought they had the same economic opportunity. And what Seth just said earlier in the program about when people ask him why he stayed here, it's love of place. And thank God for Seth and people like that, because I don't know what the economy would be if we didn't have such a special place in upstate New York and people weren't willing to withstand these burdens to try to chase that American dream. But New York State, and to Seth's dilemma, for lack of a better word, local governments, make it incredibly difficult.
All right. So before I ask Seth about that, I'm not doing my job if I don't offer at least a little bit of what I think some people would push back with this here and say, your friends in those other states are paying a lower tax burden, but they're not getting as much house for their money. They're not getting as much land for their money, and that you can live with more space, more comfortably here, and that there is a trade-off there.
Maybe if it's dollar to dollar, but they also have economic prospects and the ability to earn more money and the ability to, invest in a bigger home down there because of the value of their wages. That doesn't exist up here. Right. So, I think, yeah, it's not an apples to apples.
Okay. Seth, what do you make of Mike's phone call?
I think, as any business owner looking at ROI, looking for a return on the investment, I don't know the specific numbers to use Mike's quote, but, to spend the most and be 20th, it'd be one thing if we spent the most and we're number one. But to see that gap of how much we spend and the lack of return on that investment, I think is probably what's most disheartening to somebody like myself. Clearly having a healthy, educated electorate and public should be one of our main priorities. But to see the system at play and to see all of the various bureaucratic yellow tape that seems to absorb a lot of where that money is not only coming from, but where it's going, I think mostly for business owners, they would say it's the lack of the return on their investment that's the most disheartening as far as being able to go, love of place, having gone away for 3-4 years, 5 years living in South Florida, taking advantage of a real estate market down there and proper timing. I am one of the fortunate ones to come back. I do have locally a great group of friends who have all kind of gone and come back, but it's not that we don't sacrifice along the way, whether it be, in size of home or, tax. There's a lot of factors that weigh into it. But in the end, we love upstate New York. Greg loves upstate New York. You love it. We want to be here. We just need a little more reason to come back. So.
All right. And when you mentioned bureaucratic tape, you think businesses like yours are overregulated in this state?
It's just that there's a toll. There's a token to be exchanged for every, whether it's DEC and petroleum or in my case, I deal with everybody from workers' comp and board of health and cigarette taxes. Cigarette's a great one. The pack of Marlboros was $6.79 when I opened my store 10 years ago. I made 90 cents a pack. Now I charge $11.29. I make 90 cents a pack. People just tell me they're driving to Pennsylvania. The free market will find ways around it. I don't know if we're a healthier public or we're gaining more tax revenue from cigarettes, whatever that is. But there is every single, from paying for a certificate of authority to be able to even collect tax, I now have to pay for that. These are things that I think the state should be kind of rewarding us and maybe giving us tax breaks as business owners to take care of some of their bidding and what we do. It's a big responsibility, and it seems like the state generally is just waiting to punish you at every next turn, which is really disheartening.
I heard the journalist David K. Johnston recently talk about regulations because in his new book on the Trump administration, he sort of takes a shot at the Trump administration for just sort of arbitrarily slashing regulations and sort of saying any regulation eliminated is a good thing. Johnston tries to argue that there are some regulations that are onerous, that are unfair, that are obviously ridiculous, and there are some that are there for a very good reason. And he points to West Virginia, which has coal slurry impoundments, and the Trump administration has rolled back some of the safety regulations about coal slurry. And we have seen environmental risks that are very serious there. But, so Seth, I guess I want to ask you, I don't hear you saying all regulation is bad, right? I mean, there are some good reasons for some regulation.
Yeah, I guess we got to have some, right?
I'm making you say that there are some that make sense.
There are some that make sense, yes, of course. As a libertarian, it really disheartens me to say that. But this day and age, I think it's more about, again, to me, it's where we're spending the money. It's not even the fact we're spending it at this point. It's what are we getting for our investment?
Okay. I mean, that's so if you're in the room as an advisory committee of small business owners, you'd say, I'm not saying there should be no regulation. I'm saying that a lot of these are sort of capricious. They're just not really sensical. And that they penalize us. Is that what you're saying?
Ranking 50th in so many of these things, it's hard to see how far out really we are out of whack in this. So clearly we are being overregulated, overtaxed. We need to rein in a lot of that. To say that we should get rid of all of it, I think we could cut back significantly and still seem like a pretty regulated environment, climate in general.
Okay, Greg?
I think that's exactly right. Nobody here, even though I'll probably be painted with this brush, and I have been painted before, I think would argue that we need to have a lawless structure in New York State, that there could be no business regulations. But there is there needs to be a balance with everything that we do. And in New York State, I think the biggest problem we hear from two things, from the regulatory side of things, from employers, is one, often a one-size-fits-all model. There is a business or a subset of employers in one part of the state that are taking advantage of something, and all of a sudden, tens of thousands of employers, hundreds of thousands in certain cases, now have to adjust to a new mandate that has administrative costs. The regulation has implementation costs. There's actual punitive cost. There is a bottom-line cost. So many times, we take very small problems and apply very large solutions. And the second issue that we hear from employers all the time is that most employers, in my experience, want nothing more than to know what the rule is, how do they comply with it, what does it cost, and then let me go on my way, run my business, make my money. A lot of the state agencies, through I think this has just been a culture of bureaucracy over 30, 40, 50 years, maybe as long as bureaucracies existed. They're not assistive agencies in terms of helping businesses, particularly small employers, first-time employers, with how to comply with a lot of these things. They serve as punitive agencies. They serve as revenue generators for the state. I think that is sort of a holistic problem with the way regulations are enforced in New York State.
All right, I'm late for our only break, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. Robert, Jack, Lucky on the phone. We'll get your phone calls. We're talking to Greg Brilla, the executive director of Unshackle Upstate. I want to ask Greg if you want to get online and see their website, because I've got their whole policy agenda and preferences for 2018 online where? Greg?
UnshackleUpstate.com. Our policy agenda will be front and center. Find us on Twitter at UnshackleNY and on Facebook at Unshackle Upstate.
Seth Olney is here from the only place on Cuca Lake, which is a remarkable place. It's a regional destination. I say that because covering it, the region journalistically, it's been compared to the Oakville Grocery, the Finger Lakes, and Seth always likes to say, we're our own place. We're not anybody else. But I just want to give you a little bit of reference. And before the hour's up, we'll make sure you understand, we'll put a little cap on what's been going on with Seth and his business. So let's get that only break. Come back to your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, homelessness among LGBTQ youth. And now, when it comes to the homeless population, a big percentage is made up of kids in the LGBTQ population. Why is that? Well, there are some reasons that are a little bit more obvious and some less obvious. And there are real risks involved. We'll work through the issue and talk about what's being done to change it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Robert in Fairport next. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. It just seems to me that state government in New York State exists primarily to perpetuate itself. It pays itself very lavish pensions. It contributes to the fact that the state has huge fixed costs. It seems that the size of government is never right-sized based on population or the ability to pay. If you're looking at something like pensions, you're talking about a lot of people. If you look through New York, a lot of administrators in New York schools, over $100,000 a year in pensions. That's equivalent to having about $3 to $4 million invested for each one of those pensions. If you were to annuitize those pensions, workers in the private sector have 401ks that are subject to market risk. There is no market risk for these pension people. The other thing that most people probably don't realize is that New York State pensions are exempt from state taxation. Not a penny is paid in taxes on the recipients of those pension dollars.
Robert, thank you. Greg Brilla, go ahead.
Well, I think Robert brought up some great points. I hope he doesn't get me to agree that we're going to impose a new tax on anybody, but there's some inherent unfairness in that. And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, that when times were better, I think some poor financial decisions were made in Albany well before I was doing this or following any of this. And when you talk about pension reform, it's always looking forward. Those are contracts that are protected by the New York State Constitution. But there needs to be, I would argue, a move to a defined contribution 401k. But in absence of that, there needs to be increased employee contributions. That goes for healthcare costs too. Those legacy benefits of pensions and healthcare are huge drivers of cost at the state government level, also at the local government level, which we've been talking about a lot today.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Jack and Grace next. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, hi, Evan. Thanks so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. I've spent my entire life in New York State. I grew up on Long Island. I've had a good education. I've been able to raise four adult children. And, you know, quite honestly, a couple of thoughts. I've never had to be on Medicaid. None of my family members have had to be on Medicaid. But the idea of cutting Medicaid aid health care to the poor is basically what Medicaid is aimed at. There's a lot of discussion that can be had about health care costs in this country. And I think by any fair measure, we pay more than, I believe, any other place in the world for health care. To say that there's a race to the bottom, that New York State needs to be competitive and cut costs and support to the poor, I think is a wrong move. Even though I have not been affected by this, I would love to pay less in taxes, but to start cutting aid to the poor is the wrong place, in my opinion. Now, pension costs and all these other costs, I worked for Kodak, where my career was as an engineer. We had good benefits, good pay, and of course, that deteriorated over time. And I think, the change that we're seeing in our country where folks' pensions and folks are worried about their health care costs, about their rising costs and fixed pensions and elimination of pension plans, going to 401k. You know, I don't think we're the wealthiest country in the world. We got to take a look at who's gaining from our economy and how is it being shared. I look at the wealthiest people in New York State, and they're absolutely right. They will leave, and that will be a big hit, folks like Tom Golisano leaving New York State. He has that right, and he's done it. And that will eventually, all those costs that he used to pick up from in his taxes will have to be picked up by the rest of us. But to say that, we need to race to the bottom, I think is the wrong discussion. We should look at, are all our states in competition with each other? We see that happening with Amazon. Is that where we're headed? So that it's a cutthroat approach across the country? I don't think so. Anyway, thanks. Jack, thanks for taking my comment.
Yeah, Jack, thanks for the phone call. So, Greg, a lot of that is aimed at what you had said earlier. Why don't you go ahead?
I thought that was a thoughtful phone call. And I wouldn't advocate for a race to the bottom either. Maybe I'd advocate for a race to 45th place. But further, if you want to offer the most expensive and the best programs or services in New York State, somebody has to pay for that. And with the way the tax structure and the business and regulatory environment is in this state, we are losing employers. We are losing population year after year. The numbers speak for themselves. So we have to do something to attract a tax base back to the state if we're going to pay for anything. Which is why I go back to a point from earlier. There always needs to be a balance. If you tax and regulate taxpayers out of this state, you don't have anybody to pay for anything. And that's not to say that we want to cut services to the core, myself or I think anybody. But there needs to be a balance or else it's never going to work in the long term.
I want to read a couple of comments from Debbie on Twitter. She says, two things. My foster daughter in Houston has a junction box and a gas line running through her bottom kitchen cupboards. Regulations are needed in some places. But she goes on to say, my great niece and fiance are going to Charleston, South Carolina, as he cannot find a livable wage in the food service industry here. They are taking my only great with them. We are devastated. They also think rentals are much cheaper there. So there's a family talking about seeing people move away, as Greg described with his own friends. I've seen a lot of comments and emails about this. And before we lose the hour, I want to return to Seth Olney's story, because we first brought it to you here on Connections a while back. And it does look like the Olney place is not going to close. Were you were really thinking about ending your business for a while there? To remind listeners, his is a market in Delhi that added a beer garden. Added how many taps?
The key here is that we had our license to serve on premise before
already.
We ever did the addition. So, however, beer is dispensed is of no moment to the state liquor authority. So,
but how many taps did you add?
The success of the can and bottle program that we had in drinking on premise, to me, gave me the confidence to invest. Mm-hmm. And I think going back to what Greg was saying is those uncertainties that the business owners experience, whether it's through taxation or policy or anything else, kind of is what gives us caution to continue to invest. And for myself, I saw the market responding quite well, and I said, let me make this investment to expand my business. I added in a small deck in addition with 12 draft beer taps there. And to me, it was is just as prominent and better to be able to sell a growler of Three Heads or Lost Burrow beer on draft as it was a bucket of Coronas in the side lawn. So I made that investment, made that leap, and with it, the town, I guess, didn't share that vision with me and decided that based on some erroneous complaints by very few of my neighbors, they were going to try to retract that special use permit, led to an Article 78 petition, a battle with state liquor authority, because I was unaware of some of the regulations that were in play. Had to essentially sue the town just to find my place, to hold my place with the state liquor authority, to have my chance to have my say. After almost three years of being in legal battles with them, I have since been back to Manhattan twice. I've even repealed prohibition in the process, as you may recall. So the trials and tribulations I've gone through are pretty specific to my case. But we are coming through them, and yes, I do absolutely plan on opening for my now 11th season in my 10th year.
If SLA had told you, look, the town's right, you know, by the way, there was a referendum in the town last year in which town residents voted overwhelmingly to.
After 2 years of being in litigation, it was discovered by the town, because our small government is so small and doesn't even have a post office, Barrington was not recognized by the state liquor authority. And of course, on all my licenses and every other application I've ever put, I've put Penn Yan. In this case, Barrington did not come up on anybody's radar. And I'm not the only person that sells alcohol. We have great wineries, a distillery. So everybody was kind of caught off guard when this was discovered. But yeah, back in August, Chairman Bradley from the state liquor authority brought it to my attention at a meeting that my attorney and I attended in New York, that we were, in fact, not supposed to have that license and therefore could not knowingly expand my license to include the new addition that I had built. So they said, go back home, form a referendum, get this on the ballot, repeal prohibition, come back and see us.
Yeah. So this is really making me want to start a business. So, but it happened. So you got it on the ballot. It worked out for you. And now here you are. If the SLA, though, had said, sorry, the town was right, you were thinking about that. That was it for the Olney place closed?
It would have to convert to something else. I mean, I've made craft beer in general, draft beer. It is a profitable. Look how many, we have 400 breweries, you know, in statewide now. I think almost as much as anybody. Clearly, it's a business we all like to be in. I have a lot of respect to those out there manufacturing and really kind of making it happen. It's an incredible craft beverage and food scene that we've been able to see in the last decade. And to not take part in that, to me, is as much as it was the profitability, it was just the fun. I mean, it's a culture. And when you're in such a small place, I'm the one store for 20 miles. So you want people to drive 10, 12 miles to go have a beer and then drive back to keep the money local, to keep the fun local. Craft beer was a big part of it for me.
And that means he will still be selling the Rachel, which is Greg Barilla. The best sandwich in the Finger Lakes.
I will certainly be your newest customer in your 11th year.
We're looking forward to having you, yeah.
So the Rachel is what, by the way?
As you know, it's the turkey Reuben. It's It's this nice crispy marble rye and our sweet and succulent Thousand Island with some salty turkey and Swiss cheese and some crunchy coleslaw and, you know, Thousand Island running down your knuckles as you're looking at the lake with a craft beer. And it's a popular sandwich. We actually just did a great collaboration with Chris and Isabel over at the Wienery last week. They let us kind of have a takeover celebration of the only place.
Over at the FLX Wienery?
At the Wienery, yeah. It was great. So, and it was standing room only for several hours. Paris, my best friend and chef back home, we actually were supposed to kind of host and plate and kind of shake hands, and instead we were making sandwiches for 4 hours. So it was great.
But what a great view of collaboration, because I was just about to say to Seth, you have no right to close for 6 months and deny the world to Rachel. But look at that. FLX Wienery is sort of your competition.
And I mean, they're over
on a different lake, but they're...
There's two places to eat lunch 20 minutes apart. How many places? If you were speaking of Charleston, a great food scene, I was there in my 6 months off. I am able to travel and see some of these other great places and bring some back these innovative ideas. I was in Charleston about 3 weeks ago, and I think from the epicenter of downtown, within a two-mile radius, you can be to 900 different places to eat. So I like to go and see these other places and bring back some of that goodness to the Finger Lakes.
You're going to be opening when, in April?
We're opening April 20th. Our 10-year anniversary is April 23rd, so that Friday, I think we're going to have a long weekend and kind of a celebration, and looking forward to it.
Surprising number, I shouldn't say surprising, a number of Connections listeners have been asking about what's been going on with Seth Olney and his business since the last time he was on the program, so you're updated now. Thanks for taking the time to come all the way in from Cuca Lake.
Thank
from
you to
Barrington.
Both of you, Greg. It was great to listen to you. A great young leader for our future. And as much as you want to see me make a political run, I think probably Greg is more suited for it than I at this point.
So. I'm counting on that.
I'm not talking politics here, though. You know, you outed yourself as an anti-regulation libertarian, and some of our listeners are not going to like that, Seth.
Compassionate libertarian.
The only place on Cuca Lake. Thank you, Seth Olney. Good seeing you.
Thank you, Evan.
Greg Brill, Unshackle Upstate, online at unshackleupstate.com. Thanks for coming in here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Short break. More Connections coming up.